Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Although more than 2.5 billion people worldwide need one or more assistive products such as wheelchairs, hearing aids, and apps that support communication, nearly 1 billion are denied access to these life-changing tools, particularly in poorer countries. The finding comes in a report published on Monday by the World Health Organization, WHO, and the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF. The report contains recommendations to expand availability and access. It also highlights the importance of raising awareness of needs and implementing policies that promote greater inclusion. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called on countries to fund and prioritize access to assistive technology and give everyone a chance to live up to their potential. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has appealed for greater commitment to diversity in the wake of the killing of 10 people in a racist attack at a supermarket in a predominantly black neighborhood of Buffalo in upstate New York on Saturday. The attack was carried out by 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, who is white. Most of the victims were African American. The Secretary General was appalled by this vile act of racist, violent extremism, UN Deputy Spokesperson Farhan Haq said in a statement on Sunday night. The UN chief condemns racism and discrimination in the strongest terms, he said, stressing we must all work together towards building more peaceful and inclusive societies. Finally, with only 3 years left to achieve the goal of eliminating all child labor by 2025, countries are meeting at a conference in Durban, South Africa this week to accelerate action. The International Labour Organization, ILO, reports that some 160 million boys and girls, nearly 1 in 10 children worldwide, are still in child labour and numbers are rising. The COVID-19 pandemic also threatens to push back years of gains. In his opening speech on Sunday, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa urged delegates to commit to taking far-reaching actions against what he called an enemy to development and progress. ILO Chief Guy Ryder told participants that while some may say child labor is an inevitable consequence of poverty, this is wrong, and tackling root causes such as household poverty is essential. He said child labor is a violation of a basic human right, and our goal must be that every child everywhere is free from it. Deanne Penn, UN News.
And in the second hour, following Radio Eco Shock and headlines from Democracy Now!,
the dynamics of possible nuclear extinction, Noam Chomsky.
Nuclear war is the black swan we can never see, except in that brief moment when it is killing us. We delay eliminating the risk at our own peril. Now is the time to address the threat, because now we are still alive.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
That's right, after Radio Eco Shock.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alice Smith.
It sounds impossible. An expert with decades of experience says global warming between 4 to 6 degrees could lead to mass die-off of the plankton that produces up to 70% of the world's oxygen. Forget rising seas, Sergei Petrovsky says. We are more likely to stifle than drown. I'll also be talking with the Canadian campaigner who got climate warning stickers put on gas pumps, and he hopes to take that global. But first, we're going to visit with an economic anthropologist and one of Sweden's leading thinkers on the economy, money, and climate change. Alf Hornberg is hoping the next economic crisis can help us change. Is it happening now? I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio Eco Shock. A best of Radio Eco Shock replay. Imagine technology as a system that gathers up days of people's lives, mixes them with nature, physical things and living things, and then channels products towards a minority, in fact, to a dwindling number of the wealthy elite. All the while, the same technology reduces our chances for survival. I think that's how the Swedish author and anthropologist Alf Hörnberg sees it, but only he can say. Let's ask him. Professor Alf Hörnberg, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Now, most of us think of technology as good ideas, more tools to enable an easier or richer life. What's wrong with our wonderful world of cars, dishwashers, and cell phones?
Right. Well, the notion that technology is basically about ingenious ideas is, I think, erroneous. And it goes, you know, a couple of centuries back in time, or rather it's been erroneous for that time. I would argue that up until the Industrial Revolution, it was largely correct. I mean, inventions and technologies were about people who figured out new practical ways of doing things. But beginning with the Industrial Revolution, say in the late 18th century, there was a second set of circumstances that was absolutely crucial for a technology to exist at all. And not only engineering knowledge, but also the social rates of exchange of resources and labor on the world market, what I would call the world system. So differences in prices, for example, raw cotton from the cotton plantations in the U.S. versus the prices of cotton textiles produced in the U.K., these exchange relations were crucial for the very existence of technology. I would put it very drastically by saying, for example, that the steam engine would not have existed without the slave plantations in southeastern United States.
Well, now it seems everyone from greens to super capitalists are looking for the next technology that will save us from technology. Are there other options?
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say you're absolutely right. This is one of the most difficult things to sort of deconstruct, this belief in technological progress, because everybody, regardless of ideological color, subscribes to it. Everybody believes that there will be a new technology that will make us sustainable and so on. My fundamental argument is that we should not be looking for new technological solutions. We should be looking at money. We should be looking at the economy as the problem that both generates these unsustainable and inequitable technologies and destroys our environment. We should be thinking in terms of how our ideas on money and the economy can be changed instead.
Well, right. Speaking in Paris a couple of years ago, you suggested only an economic crisis would open doorways for meaningful change at the political level, and it looks like we're entering another crisis now. Does that give you more hope?
Well, I must admit that I felt quite a lot of hope around 2008. There was a lot of talk of a global financial crisis, and I was wondering if this might, in fact, shape a new kind of political discussion, dialogue about the role of the economy in human society and the biosphere and so on. But now, I mean, this year, 2016, 8 years will have passed, and I don't see any major changes, really. So I think it will require more of a crisis, a more fundamental crisis, to make it feasible to talk about these things in a more detached way. I think we're way too comfortable yet, at least in Europe and North America, to really, really start rethinking what modern civilization is all about and technology is all about.
I totally agree with you. But I did notice after the shock of 2008 that a few communities started local currencies, or at least barter dollars. Could an alternative currency actually help reduce carbon emissions?
Yes, I'm quite convinced that that's the way to approach it. But I've been looking at the great number of experiments with alternative currencies that have been conducted over the past 30 or 40 years, actually, the so-called let's economies, local exchange trading systems, and you have Ithaca hours, you have Bristol pounds, you have a number of different kinds of community currencies, alternative currency schemes, and I do think that they suffer from certain, you know, they have certain problems, and one of them is that they're generally initiated from the grassroots level, which sounds democratic and nice, but which means that they are generally they're sort of antagonistic vis-a-vis the establishment, which generally means that they are marginalized and they survive only as long as a few enthusiasts manage to keep their energy up. I mean, if they rely on local people's enthusiasm, then they're doomed. We need a system that really is backed up by the authorities and that will continue regardless of individual enthusiasm. And I think the other thing that is I would like to see changed in these initiatives is that the currency, I would call it a complementary currency, because it would exist alongside the formal general currency. But this complementary currency needs to specify what kinds of goods and services it can be exchanged for. And to my mind, it would be important to relocalize the economy by saying that this complementary currency can be used only to buy goods and services that have been produced within a certain radius geographically of the point of purchase. It could be 30 kilometers or 50 kilometers. That's not that important. But the important thing is to have this complementary currency distinguishing between locally produced goods and services on the one hand and what is being sold on the globalized market on the other.
Well, I guess it goes without saying if we have local economies, we're not shipping things long distance using fossil fuels, and there's a greater chance we're not abusing someone else's rights by hiring dirt cheap labor. I want to get on to climate change. Do you see that as another big problem for humanity, or is it the ultimate threat to survival?
Oh, absolutely. It is the ultimate threat, and I understand completely that why it engages millions of people all over the world and why we have these enormous conferences. People are seriously worried, and they have every reason to be worried about climate change.
Alf Hornberg, you became more widely known after your 2001 book, The Power of the Machine. This year you will publish another titled Global Magic. I realize I'm about to ask a huge question, but can you give us a couple of examples of the way your thinking has evolved in the last 15 years?
Yeah, one of the examples I would give has to do with the distinction that I have often been asked to make between magic and technology. And I've found it analytically challenging and difficult to pin down exactly what I mean about machine fetishism, which is a concept that implies that technology is really a version, a modern version of magic. And actually, just last year, I came up with a very concrete example to illustrate what I'm saying. And my point of departure is to compare coins and keys. Now, coins and keys are little pieces of metal. And according to what is known as actor network theory, and people who theorize about how objects and artifacts are given agency, how they actually intervene in social processes, humans delegate agency to things, to artifacts, to the things they make. And this is true for both coins and keys, I would argue. We delegate, we let the coins and the keys act, so to speak. They have social impacts. But there's a crucial difference between coins and keys, and this is what I really would like to emphasize. The agency of coins is contingent on what humans believe about them, about their subjective ideas. money would not have any agency if we did not believe that money was valuable, whereas keys have agency. They turn a lock simply because of the way they're physically designed, not because of what humans believe about them. And I would argue that this simple distinction is what distinguishes magic from technology. And I would argue, actually, as a corollary, that very much of modern technology somewhere along the line is contingent on human beliefs. So I would argue in that sense, it is a version of magic.
We talked about money, but the real underpinnings of our financial system seem to remain off limits and mysterious. I mean, scientists are allowed to study natural systems in tremendous detail, how sea creatures reproduce and so on. But who really owns what is a secret matter for private banks and private corporations, even if they threaten to ruin the natural world. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I agree with your understanding of finance completely. And I do think that finance is actually the point where magic enters the picture. I think after 2008 and the financial crisis, most of us have become aware of the fact that there's a kind of a magic about money. I mean, for us here in Europe, it's pretty amazing to hear that the U.S. in just the last couple of years or so has become a major exporter of fossil fuels again. And you wonder how is this possible? You know, we thought, speaking of net energy and so on, we thought that U.S. had to go to war in the Middle East to secure its oil imports, and here we're hearing no, the U.S. can fix its own oil at this point. And the more we think about it, of course, we realize that this would be impossible without finance, that it's actually what goes on Wall Street and other contexts like that that makes it possible to pump oil out of the U.S. and run technology on it. So finance, the magic of money, is actually making American oil an active material component in the economy. Finance underwrites the agency, the material agency of oil. And that goes to show how magic actually intervenes, impinges, and becomes fundamental to technology.
But if we stop believing that, we're told, if we try and change the rules of the game, it's all going to fall apart and we'll all starve in the dark in our cities. How do we manage to rationalize and become so blind to these things?
Yeah, I think we have a lot to learn about how human perceptions and worldviews actually intervene in very tangible ways in the way we organize global society, technologically, economically. We can no longer believe that the physical world, the material world, and the world of human ideas are two separate parts of reality, because they do intermingle. And what we have to do is to understand how this occurs, and we have to maintain, I think, importantly, an analytical distinction between the pre-human world, thermodynamics, gravity, the material world that we used to call nature on one hand, and all the kinds of social conventions and symbolic systems and ideas and so on that we develop in human societies. We have to maintain an analytical distinction to be able to say this is nature and this is society. But then, of course, we know that the nature and society are all the time intermingled in our bodies, in our landscapes, our technologies. They're always mixed up. But we should know what comes from nature and what comes from society. I think we shouldn't let go of that distinction.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the Swedish author and anthropologist from Lund University, Alf Hernberg. Alf, picking up on what you just said, I interviewed the popular German journalist Christian Schwagerl about his book, The Anthropocene, The Human Era and How It Shapes Our Planet. What dangers lurk in proclaiming this to be the new human age?
Yeah, a colleague and I actually published a little piece on this in the Anthropocene Review of the journal a couple of years ago, and it's been quite widely cited. The argument that we have advanced in that paper is that if we call this the age of humans, we're implying that it's humanity, an undifferentiated human species, that has created all the problems we have in the Anthropocene, climate change, and so on. Whereas my colleague and I would argue that it's historically a minority of the human species who have propelled these changes by inaugurating the Industrial Revolution and consequently the Anthropocene. So we would prefer other denominations. I would personally prefer the technocene. I know my colleague Andreas Malm coined the concept capitalocene and so on. There are other words that would make it more clear that this is not humanity as a whole that has developed this new era. It's a small privileged elite who have actually driven these changes.
Okay, we started talking about technology, and people grudgingly admit money could be a root of evil, but certainly not technology. Are you suggesting we can unplug and walk away from the technomass we have created, and wouldn't billions of people die in short order if we did that?
I think very much would emerge sort of automatically out of a fundamental change of the economy. And I'm not at all convinced that sort of getting off the technology, so to speak, would put a lot of people in peril. In fact, I would argue the opposite. It would liberate people to start using the land and their labor time for more sustainable things than we're doing now. Actually, there is enough soil and other resources on this planet to support the population we have now without fossil fuels. In fact, if you want to be really drastic, another colleague of mine figured out that if everybody was a vegan, now, of course, we're not all vegans, but if all humans were vegans, there would be room for about 30 billion of us on this planet without cutting down one more tree and without fossil fuels. So really, I think that this myth that, you know, we have to have fossil fuels and modern technology in order to feed two of the world's 7-8 billion people, I think is a myth, definitely.
Okay. Another justification is the idea that the geographical locus of this collection machine, as you might call it, has an ability to shift over time. We think of the rise of Japan, Korea, and now China as centers of not just technology, but the accumulation of capital. The wealth might appear anywhere, we say. Or does technology always need that hinterland of slums and poverty somewhere else to function?
I think it does. I've published a few texts where I use the notion of the zero-sum world or a zero-sum game. I do think that technology is very much about saving time and space by some people at the expense of time and space lost by other people, so that what we think of as technological progress or growth or capital accumulation is really about developing capacities to liberate and save time and space, human time and natural space, in some sectors of the world system at the expense of other sectors where human time and natural space are lost and are in fact used to subsidize those gains that some of us with enough purchasing power make.
Alf Hornberg, what does economic anthropology tell us about climate change and our prospects of avoiding a climate catastrophe?
I'm not sure that economic anthropology in itself directly would respond to that, but there are perspectives from economic anthropology that I think could be applied. For example, our almost universal human concern with reciprocity. The classic, of course, is Marcel Mauss' book, The Gift, where he draws on a Maori informant who early in the 20th century says that if you you receive a gift, you have to repay it somehow. And I think this can actually be applied to climate change. There's a lot of talk now about climate justice, and we know that portions of world population have been using much too large parts of the atmosphere as sinks for carbon dioxide at the expense of other populations who are suffering from more floods and droughts and so on than others. There's a kind of a reciprocity problem about climate and climate justice.
Yeah, so I guess it's a crass question, but all of us are asking ourselves inside, what would climate justice cost us, the average person in America or Scandinavia? What do we have to give up in order to get that?
Yeah, I wish I was good at remembering figures, but let's just put it this way, that in order for these changes to really materialize that people talked about in Paris when everybody was cheering about how we're now entering the post-fossil age and so on, if those changes would really materialize, it would require very, very much and a very, very radical change of lifestyle for most of us. I know that, for example, in Sweden, carbon dioxide emissions, not only from what we produce in Sweden, but if we include also the stuff we consume that has been produced, much of it in China, we have about emissions of about 12 tons of carbon per year per capita, which is about twice the formal statistics that say, like, okay, Sweden has about 5 or 6 tons per capita, but that's just production-based. And if we want to get down to, say, around 1 ton per capita, you can imagine that it would mean reducing our consumption levels to about 1/12 of where we are now. And we're talking that scale. So it's a major change for Europeans and Americans.
Yeah, personally, I think one idea is to get rid of the idea of new, that we have to buy everything new. There's already so many products in the world, too many cars already, all of that. I think we just have to start using used things. That's one answer. Well, you know, the cynic would say that words like justice and morality or ethics don't matter to enough people to change our course, but I have noticed a series of older people like you, myself, and James Hansen seem motivated partly by fear for our grandchildren's future. As an anthropologist, is that a viable driver for human action?
Yeah, it's a good question. As you say, I have grandchildren myself, and it makes me think a lot more about what this planet will look like 70 or 80 years from now. I think the concept of morality is very important in these discussions, in particular because modern neoclassical or neoliberal economics has a very special relation to morality that I think is problematic. I've often tried to test the concept of unequal exchange on economists, and they say, well, we never heard of it, really. We don't use that word. And I think the whole notion of unequal exchange, which is a moral concept, basically, the fact that it's not, doesn't sort of ring a bell for economists, it tells you that morality is not their main point, you know, it's not their main issue. Their main issue is the mechanisms that determine prices on the world market. But what is actually being exchanged on the world market in terms of energy, matter, embodied labor, and so on, land, embodied land, is not as important as whether those price mechanisms operate the way they should, according to economists. So morality is a major issue, but to get back to your question, whether it's enough to really make us change our behavior, I cannot answer, and I certainly don't want to suggest that I personally am doing all that much for the world, except, you know, writing my books and getting engaged in the debates. I do think we need major decisions, structural decisions about the economy that need to be taken democratically in parliaments. I don't think we should be hoisting the burden onto individuals because we feel bad about the world as it is, and we have so little power as individuals So I don't think it's really correct to let us carry the burden of guilt as well for what's happening.
Well, some people say we've been brainwashed by a powerful elite. I mean, there are mega corporations and the media are owned by just a few corporations, but that sort of lets us off the hook. And I wonder if it's true. I mean, is it the rest of us? When politicians say, well, look, I don't have the political support to make these changes, people want what they want. How can we answer that?
Hmm. Yeah, well, so far we're just too comfortable in Europe and North America to really make drastic changes in our lives. But I do believe that crises of one kind or another, and perhaps in particular financial crisis, could quickly change our readiness to change. So I think we may need some kind of push from the economy to really change our behavior. And people are apparently very versatile. I mean, we only need to recall the 1930s, which was the last major economic depression. And as far as I understand, I wasn't around then, but as far as I understand, people very readily, you know, plowed up their lawns and planted potatoes and changed their lifestyle very quickly as an adjustment to the economic changes that they were experiencing. And I think that that's what we can probably hope for in the future as well.
Well, our time together has been too short. We can't possibly capture your long career of powerful ideas. Alf Hernberg has been one of the more difficult and rewarding guests that I have researched. You can find links to learn more yourself in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. We reached Alf at the prestigious Lund University in Sweden, where he has been a professor of human ecology since 1993. Thank you so much for sharing your time and ideas with us.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. You have heard that a warming world will flood coastal cities. Hotter seas will drive more extreme weather events. All that may not matter if a new paper on plankton is correct. The authors say if the ocean life that creates more than half the oxygen in the atmosphere dies off, we are more likely to stifle than drown. To understand this new threat, let's get to work. The paper is called Mathematical Modeling of Plankton Oxygen Dynamics Under the Climate Change. From the Department of Mathematics at the University of Leicester in Britain, we've reached the co-author Sergei Petrovsky. Sergei, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Just to disturb our listeners a little bit, your peer-reviewed study suggests there is a tipping point in ocean heating that could drive plankton into extinction. Is that right?
Yes. I'm afraid our model shows it quite clearly.
Well, with something that big, we better start at the bottom. Most of us don't know where our oxygen comes from. What is plankton, really?
Plankton is a kind of generic term. Plankton applies to, well, almost everything that floats in the water, in the oceans. And usually it's divided into two large taxonomic groups, like phytoplankton, which are small aquatic plants, and zooplankton, which are small aquatic animals like shrimps or similar.
Could we see an individual species of plankton if we held just one in our hands?
I guess this is a kind of typical confusion. Plankton organisms are not necessarily small. So some of them can indeed be just a fraction of a millimeter, but some of them can be as large as 10 centimeters or even more. So you certainly can hold some of them in hands, yes.
Okay, I'm just trying to picture it. So phytoplankton are the tiny plants in the ocean that create the majority of oxygen in the air. How do they do that? And the key question here is, why is there a net gain of oxygen to the atmosphere?
Phytoplankton are not much more different in that aspect compared to all other plants. This is one of the generic features of most of the plants, that they consume CO2 and turn it by the process known as photosynthesis into a stock of the nutrients, a kind of sugar, which they use for their growth, and oxygen, free oxygen, as essentially byproduct.
How do scientists know that ocean temperature is the key determinant driving net production of oxygen by plankton?
There have been a few studies in about 10, 15 years ago, so several studies actually, and people just measured actually how the rate of oxygen production depends on their water temperature. And their key point here, important for the understanding, is that plants, all plants and phytoplankton as well, do not only produce oxygen, they produce oxygen in the daytime because sunlight is an essential component of that, but they also consume oxygen during the night because as well as all living creatures, they need oxygen to essentially to breathe, so for their metabolism. And the point is that their rate of consumption, oxygen consumption, and the rate of oxygen production, they depend differently on the temperature. So the net oxygen production, which is obviously the difference between production and consumption, it appears to decrease with the increase in temperature. That was something that was observed in the ocean.
And yet I was surprised and a little confused to read in your paper that scientists are not really sure whether oxygen production from plankton will increase or decrease as the seas warm. We don't really know that yet?
Well, we tried to be careful with that because I said there was several studies about that, which means that in fact only a handful of phytoplankton species was checked. Right, but any plankton community consists of hundreds and hundreds of different species, and currently, at our current state of knowledge, we cannot rule out that there are species that respond differently to the increase in water temperature. So that's we just try to keep all possibilities open.
Well, fair enough. How did you deal with that uncertainty in trying to predict the impact of warming on plankton?
We considered two different scenarios, that is two opposite scenarios. When one of them is when the net oxygen production actually decreases with the water temperature, as was observed in the ocean, at least for some species. And the second opposite, when the oxygen production actually increases with the temperature. And quite surprisingly, we observed that in both cases, even in the second case, which seems to be a good option, in both cases, their sufficiently large change in the rate of the oxygen production results in a disaster.
So any study needs a starting point, and I presume that would be our current state. And you say that maybe we're in a safe state now, or maybe it's not stable, but it's surrounded by a stable limit cycle. Could you tell us, what is a stable limit cycle?
A stable limit cycle is it's essentially a mathematical terminology originated in the area of mathematics known as dynamical systems or dynamical systems theory. And it's essentially a periodic solution. And usually people talk about a stable limit cycle, which means that wherever system is at a current moment or at the initial moment, it will be eventually attracted by this cycle, so it will start oscillating according to this periodical solution, that is limit cycle. Does it make it any clearer? Or
yes, I think I understood that. Now, no matter which model or path you worked with, as you said, it seemed to eventually lead to disaster with more warming. What is the worst case scenario?
Both these cases, between ourselves and our research group, we call them Catastrophe 1 and Catastrophe 2. They are both catastrophes, so it's a difficult choice to choose between two bad things, really. So both of them result in oxygen depletion, which in real term would mean that their oxygen concentration in the atmosphere will drop at least a few times.
Do we know how fast the ocean is warming now? And from that, could we make any prediction about when we might cross that tipping point for the survival of plankton and maybe for ourselves?
Well, that depends on how things will be going, and that very much involves the political component of this global climate change, because, there are different scenarios of further climate change, like best case and worst case. And in the worst case scenario, an increase in the global temperature, and which also means average increase in the water temperature in the oceans. So by worst case scenario, it will be about 4 degrees by the end of the century. And that would be dangerously close to the catastrophe predicted by our study.
You do say in the paper that one model suggests possible warning signs. Could you please tell us about that?
Yes, that's what we observed, is that it's not necessarily a considerable drop in the available oxygen in the atmosphere. It's more subtle, actually. Subtleness is that the oscillations, the temporal oscillations in the oxygen concentration that can be measured in the air and as well as in the oceans, the nature of these fluctuations, which are usually quite kind of random, quite chaotic, so they are going to become much more regular. So regularity is usually considered like a good thing compared to chaos. But in this case, regularity emerging in these fluctuations would likely mean that we are very close to the catastrophe.
Very interesting. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Sergei Petrovsky from the University of Leicester, UK. We're talking about the awful possibility that global warming could endanger the world's oxygen supply by killing off plankton in hotter seas. Sergei, doubt is built into the scientific process, and of course, we all want to reject such a big threat to life as being impossible. What sort of comments did you get back from the peer review process?
Well, in fact, it was one of the most positive reviews on my papers, definitely for the last several years. There were two reviewers, and both of them admitted that it's definitely very interesting and potentially very important study. And in fact, comments, there was not a lot of comments. In fact, comments were only actually supposed to increase the clarity, because their language was not good enough at some parts or some small inconsistencies. So it was purely technical, in fact.
Okay. You did factor in the animal type of plankton, the zooplankton, in your study, even though they don't produce oxygen. Why did you include them?
Sure, yes, but zooplankton does not produce oxygen, but they consume it. And any sensible model should account for a balance. So if there are species or components of the model that produce oxygen, then there may be also components that consume oxygen. I mean, we considered certain hierarchy of models. We actually started with a simple model which does not contain zooplankton. It's only phytoplankton and oxygen. And the simplest catastrophe, catastrophe one, which still result in a complete oxygen depletion, happens there. So that would correspond to the decrease in oxygen net production with the water temperature. But the second type of catastrophe, when the oxygen depletion follows as a result of the increase, surprisingly, or the increase in the oxygen net production, that only can be seen when we include additional feedbacks, additional oxygen consumption by zooplankton.
Another predicted change in the seas as they warm is more ocean stratification. If the oceans become more layered, then, as we know, essential nutrients upwelling to the plankton near the surface may not happen. Did you add this possibility to your model?
No, not yet. Not yet. And this is something which is definitely on our list of things to do. It should be made very clear that any model is essentially idealization, of course. And although we are certain, we feel confident that the main feedbacks have been included into the model, but of course there are many other factors that have not been included yet. And this details of, or some more details of oceanographic or ocean structure, like stratification, upwellings, and other things, they will need to be included, of course, which means that there is still a hope that this catastrophe is not as real as it seems now, hopefully.
It doesn't seem like a strong hope, but all right. Sergei Petrovsky, is there any way to test this theory other than living it out over history?
Oh, yes. There is at least a couple of things we are trying to arrange now by starting collaboration with other people. So first thing to do, or one way to check these predictions, would be to simply to check what may happen in a laboratory, in fact. So one can think about a relatively simple experiment, placing some phytoplankton into a controlled laboratory environment and changing temperature, checking the oxygen production, changing light intensity, all these things. So that should be doable. So we are currently trying to find a group of relevant group of biologists who could be able and willing to do that. And the second way is to look not into the future but into the past, because of course there is a very long history, a geological history of the living Earth, so to say. And geological history does show that there were a few catastrophes in the past that resulted in mass mortality of animals and plants. But of course, for the moment, it remains unclear whether the mechanism of those catastrophes was like we predicted or it was something completely different. So these are two things to move this research forward that we're currently thinking about.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that because I know the oceans have been very warm before. They even found crocodiles on Ellesmere Island in the Arctic Ocean in Canada. And just the fact that we still have plankton says that they haven't experienced any massive die-off. Wouldn't that be correct?
Well, not quite, because as I said, there were at least three or four, possibly five disastrous events in the geological history, so like long history really, like 10 million years ago. So, this mass mortality did not mean, of course, that everybody was killed. If everybody would have been killed, then there was no story to continue, really. So some relatively small group of animals and plants obviously survived after each of these catastrophes, and that was a driver for their new age in their biological evolution.
Well, ocean life is so large and complex, I'm not going to advise listeners to stock up on oxygen just yet, but that is not the purpose of your paper anyway. Sergei, what drove you to wonder about life limits in a warming ocean? And why do you suppose this really important and maybe obvious question hasn't been well studied before now?
Well, in my personal, so first part of your question, in my personal perspective, I guess it was kind of a natural stage because I used to be a senior scientist in their main Russian Oceanography Institute, which is called Shershov Oceanography Institute. And I worked there for 15 years and was heavily involved in plankton modeling. So at that time I was more interested in other things like factors controlling the spatial distribution and these sort of things. So to include oxygen into the models was, to some extent, was sort of a natural development of my interests. About the second part, I'm not really sure. I mean, I was reading a lot of papers over the last couple of years about that, and surprisingly, but it seems like most of the people just stuck on their global cycle of CO2, and then O2 is assumed to be sort of following that carbon dioxide cycle. So, and for that excessive interest to carbon dioxide cycle is, of course, understandable, because CO2 is regarded as the main agent behind the global warming. Well, I suppose it has just been overlooked, maybe.
Well, important things do get overlooked, and sometimes the most obvious questions get asked last, has been my experience. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Don't lose your hope. This catastrophe, I mean, we clearly see it in our models, but models are still models. Yeah? So it's a very large and long work ahead to check their reality of those catastrophes and to check their actual dangerous threshold in their temperature increase. For the moment, it's very roughly assessed like 6 degrees, but it can be more than that, and unfortunately it can be less than that, but it's still in the future. So by saying don't lose your hope, I am quite serious, because after my paper was published about 1 month ago, I received a lot of mail, in fact, and some people seem to be really scared. And of course, it was not my point to scare people. You know? So my point was to warn people that there may be more danger in this global climate change. So some bad things may have been overlooked, but there is no reason to panic, not yet anyway.
Thank you for saying that and for doing this research. We've been talking with Sergei Petrovsky. He co-authored the paper Mathematical Modeling of Plankton Oxygen Dynamics Under the Climate Change, as published in the Bulletin of Mathematical Biology in November of 2015. The title may sound a bit boring, and there is a lot of math in the paper, but as you've just heard, the subject is critical if we want to avoid disturbing the ecosystem that enables us all to breathe. Find links to this paper and articles about it in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Sergei, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Alex. My pleasure.
If I take only one thing away from this interview with Sergei Petrovsky, it is that reality is littered with traps. In hindsight, we can all see that a semi-intelligent species, discovering mechanical power from stored carbon riches, may well self-exterminate with them due to the carbon climate trap. That's why we have to be so cautious. But consider this. If Petrovsky is right, we may advance into the future fooled by the response of plankton. As the world warms, plankton could appear to thrive, providing lots of oxygen and sequestering ever more carbon dioxide. We all cheer. Apologists tell us our worries were overblown. But then, a limit beyond sustainable cycles is reached, and plankton worldwide could experience a mass die-off. That's another trap. It looks good until, as Petrovsky and his colleagues call it, catastrophe 2 occurs. Petrovsky tells us he was a senior scientist at the top Russian Oceanographic Institute. He specializes in plankton models. Maybe the model is wrong. Maybe our civilization is wrong. I hope the funding and the drive arrive soon to test out this plankton nightmare, rather than waiting to find out the hard way. Hey, what's this sticker on the gas pump? Me? You mean me? Cigarettes kill millions, and we warn users right on the pack. Burning gasoline kills the future. In Canada, Robert Shirky left his law practice to put us right into the climate changer driver's seat. Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on the program, Alex.
Okay, what do these climate labels on gas pumps look like?
Well, they are evocative of the tobacco warning labels. So often right now when you go gas up, there will be a 3-inch by 3-inch square on your gas pump that has an advertisement, maybe for a points program or come in and get your coffee. We're thinking on that space instead, why not have a climate change, call it a warning label, information label, or risk disclosure label, where the top half of it has an image that communicates an impact of climate change, and the lower half has some text. So some example text might read, you know, caution use of this fuel product contributes to climate change, which may cause blank. And perhaps you want to highlight ocean acidification or extreme weather or what have you. And then, of course, there'd be a little link to a website on it where that will be a resource for all the different things that an individual can do to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions footprint.
Is this happening anywhere in the world?
It is. It's actually exciting. I've been advocating for it across Canada at the local level, so asking cities and towns to pass this into law required of gasoline retailers. Across Canada, we've had councils from coast to coast endorse the concept and call on other orders of government to implement it. And that, of course, gives us great leverage in our conversation with the province and the federal government. But it was in late 2015 that the city of North Vancouver in British Columbia became the first municipality in the world to actually pass it into law. Shortly after that, two more communities came on board on the West Coast and more expect in 2016. And these were global firsts. It was in all sorts of media around the world, and we got lots of interest from around the world. And so our game plan is we actually have volunteers across the country that are harvesting email addresses of politicians from all around the world from government websites. And in the next few weeks, we're going to send this concept and say, hey, here's this idea. It's low cost. Here's why we think it's compelling. And it's happening here in Canada. You should pursue this in your jurisdiction.
Do you have any interest in the United States?
We've been working with a few groups in San Francisco, Berkeley, Santa Monica, and Seattle. And there's a few members of different environmental groups there that through our guidance have been advocating for it. And they've been able to have some success, but there's a bit of a delay because there's a case on cell phone labels that's working its way through the courts. And councillors in those communities want to see the outcome of that case before passing this thing into law. So I think you'll see more action in the United States probably in the summertime after some legal questions are then resolved.
You know, I don't think about it. I drive my car up to the pump. I grab it and fill it up. Are you trying to make me feel guilty, or what's the idea here?
Yeah, well, that's not it. It's a simple intervention. All it really does is it communicates hidden costs or externalities to end users, much in the same way, actually. I mean, you could say that pricing mechanisms, you know, like a carbon tax or a cap and trade regime, seek to capture and convey those harms, you know, via that quantitative approach to the end user. What this does is it uses a qualitative approach, so image and text, to capture and communicate these hidden costs of fossil fuels to the end user. And the idea is if you can disclose risk further downstream, that's what actually drives change upstream. So on the demand side of the equation, we have a habitual automatic behavior that's just part of the everyday fabric of living, and it's been normalized for a couple of generations. We don't even think twice about it. And if that's what you have, if that's the situation downstream, it's sort of the perfect downstream environment to almost perpetuate the status quo. And we tend to distance ourselves from the problem, so we'll point upstream, we'll say, well, it's a problem of pipelines and oil sands and offshore drilling and shipping and so on. And I think you will see some wins in that approach. But if at the end of the day, if we're not addressing the demand side of the equation, if we're not causing broader dissatisfaction with that status quo solution, it's going to be really hard to sort of transition away from fossil fuels. So all this does is it makes us feel more connected to the problem, makes it more tangible, more real, takes that faraway consequence, brings it into the here and now. And in doing so, it makes us less satisfied with the status quo. It makes us say, well, but what am I supposed to do? What are my options? And if you get, you know, if I start to say that, if you do, if our neighbors do, if an entire community does, if an entire marketplace does, you're creating this ideal social environment for reform. So all of a sudden, a politician then will have greater political capital to be able to implement climate-friendly initiatives, you know, A, B, and C. And you'll see as well, I think, auto manufacturers be incentivized to deliver alternate solutions to meet this shifted demand. So it's a simple, low-cost intervention to make the problem more real. And I think that's a necessary first step to then more meaningful reforms.
How does the amount of emissions that actually come from us, the consumers, relate to things like the tar sands and the pipeline projects?
Well, interestingly, it's actually the vast majority of emissions that come from end use. So it depends on how carbon intense your fuel choice is. So say if you get something from the oil sands, it's going to be about 30% of emissions come from extraction, processing, and moving the product. If it's say a light crude, then you're looking at something like 20% of emissions might come from upstream sources. But really, at the end of the day, it's not, when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions, it's not taking the stuff out of the earth. It's not then refining it or shipping it to a point of consumption. It's when you and I combust the product, when we burn it in our vehicles, that's actually where the vast majority of emissions come from. And separate and apart from that, I mean, if we do transition away from the internal combustion engine, then that drives so much change upstream, because I like to think, and a lot of economists would agree with this, that the value of a commodity is derived from its uses. So it's critical to ask that question, well, how do we use the product? It's critical to look at uses, because if you address that aspect, then you drive all sorts of change upstream.
Robert Cherkey, I have to ask on a personal level, how could you give up a career in law to become a climate activist? That's never going to pay very well. Take it from me.
Well, I've realized it doesn't pay very well at all. I think I understood the urgency and the gravity of the problem. And I wasn't all that happy practicing law. It wasn't as fulfilling as I might have hoped it to have been. And I was concerned about this problem. And it was actually my grandfather who, before he passed away, his last words to me were to do what you love. And I recall being at his funeral in Saskatchewan and standing over top of his grave, and my father, beside him, who had passed away a few years prior. And next to that was this empty patch of green grass. And there I was staring down at that, with those words echoing through my head, do what you love. And I realized that, hey, I'm kind of staring down mortality. We all are. And I started to ask myself some of the bigger questions and, what do I do with the time left? So I've always had a few interesting ideas for campaigns. This was one. I just eventually sort of plucked it off the back burner and transitioned to this work. And while I'm certainly, racking up debt, I can't say it is more meaningful. And we're optimistic, actually. It's tough fundraising in Canada if you lack charitable status. And given the nature of my political advocacy, I can't get charitable status. But our hope is that if we get lucky, if we get one philanthropist that says, hey, you know what, you guys are creating Global First. You've got a game plan to get this all around the world. I want to support this. I value impact, say, more than I do a tax receipt. I think that 2016 might be the year we get a bit of a break. And hopefully then I'll slowly work my way back out of debt. In the meantime, the party's on Visa and MasterCard.
Oh, Robert, we do need more like you. Now tell us how people can find out more and get this gas pump label into our own community.
Well, I'd encourage everyone listening to visit ourhorizon.org. That's www.our, like yours and mine, horizon.org. And from there, there's all sorts of resources. There's a TEDx talk, there's longer lectures, there's pre-written emails that you can send to your counselors. Easy thing to do is just take a moment to go there, learn about it, and then write your representatives. The other thing, too, if you are able to support the campaign financially, we've got a crowdfund where even a dollar or two or $5 a month, over a lot of people actually does go a long way. And with that, I can have, I'm looking to hopefully hire my first staff person to do a lot of the work. So, yeah, so two ways to help: advocate for it. One, and if you're able to contribute, and if by chance, if there is a billionaire listening to this broadcast, call me. It would be amazing to have some support. So thank you.
I wonder if we do have any billionaire listeners. We might. Okay, folks, try this out. Ourhorizon.org. You can do it. Get your local government to require climate warning labels on gas pumps. I'm Alex Smith reporting. Get all our past programs as free MP3 files at ecoshock.org. Check out my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. And tell your friends about the Radio EcoShock page on SoundCloud. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
It's a wild show every Saturday night. I would call it more like a classic AM underground radio every Saturday night. Coming up, a very interesting TUC radio with Noam Chomsky following Democracy Now's latest headlines.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's visiting Buffalo today as families there mourn the victims of Saturday's massacre, when a white 18-year-old suspect killed 10 people at a supermarket he deliberately targeted in the city's black community. Investigators say the shooter spent months carefully planning his assault and intended to continue his rampage with an attack on a second location. Amidst the mourning, calls for justice are growing. Civil rights lawyer Ben Crump spoke in Buffalo Monday.
What happened on Saturday was an act of domestic terrorism. And we have to define it as such. We can't sugarcoat it. We can't try to explain it away talking about mental illness. No, this was an act of domestic terrorism perpetrated by a young white supremacist.
We'll have the latest on the Buffalo massacre after headlines. In California, officials in Orange County say Sunday's mass shooting at a church in Laguna Woods was a politically motivated hate crime targeting the Taiwanese community.
It is believed the suspect involved was upset about political tensions between China and Taiwan.
Police named the suspect 68-year-old David Cho of Las Vegas, a Chinese immigrant and U.S. citizen. He reportedly placed Molotov cocktails around the church and chained exit doors shut before opening fire on a congregation gathered for a luncheon. Dr. John Cheng died in the assault. Four others were rushed to the hospital with gunshot wounds. On Monday, Orange County officials hailed Dr. Cheng as a hero who rushed the gunman, giving others a chance to subdue their attacker. President Joe Biden has approved a Pentagon plan to redeploy up to 500 U.S. troops to Somalia. The move largely reverses a withdrawal ordered by then-President Trump during his final days in office. The Pentagon says the troops are needed to train Somalia's army to combat al-Shabaab militants. The Pentagon's announcement came just after Hassan Sheikh Mohammed was sworn in as Somalia's president, a post he previously held from 2012 to 2017. In news from Ukraine, more than 260 Ukrainian troops have been evacuated from the besieged Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol, ending a week-long standoff. About 50 injured Ukrainian fighters were taken to a hospital in the Russian-controlled town of Novoastok. The other fighters were taken to another town under Russian control. With the plant evacuated, Russia now controls all of Mariupol, which has been left in ruins after months of fighting. The standoff at the steel plant lasted 4 months. The U.S. Senate has voted to advance a $40 billion military and economic aid package for Ukraine by a vote of 81 to 11. The Senate agreed to limit debate on the bill, setting up its passage, which is expected on Wednesday. The entire Democratic caucus supported the measure. The 11 no votes came from Republicans, including Senator Rand Paul, who temporarily stalled passage of the $40 billion package last week. Paul accused Senate leaders of trying to ram through the spending bill without any oversight on how the money is being spent. Russian President Vladimir Putin has said Russia can accept Finland and Sweden joining NATO, but not if new military bases are set up in the two countries.
As for the expansion of NATO, including through new members of the alliance, Finland and Sweden, Russia wants to inform you that it has no problems with these states, none. And so in this sense, there is no immediate threat to Russia from an expansion of NATO to include these countries. But the expansion of military infrastructure into this territory would certainly provoke our response. What that response will be, we will see what threats are created for us.
On Monday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan hinted he may block Sweden and Finland from joining NATO, but many analysts expect Turkey to back down in exchange for some concessions. Turkey's accused both countries of supporting the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is banned in Turkey. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has tested positive for COVID-19, is isolating at home with moderate symptoms. Ardern's government oversaw one of the world's most successful campaigns to stamp out the coronavirus until a wave of Omicron infections earlier this year forced New Zealand to abandon its zero COVID strategy. More than 80% of New Zealand's population is fully vaccinated, and the nation's per capita death rate from COVID is nearly 16 times lower than the U.S. In China, authorities say Shanghai has achieved zero COVID status after no new cases of community spread were detected for three consecutive days. This comes as a lockdown affecting some 25 million Shanghai residents is now in its seventh week. Public health restrictions across China this year have impacted hundreds of millions of people, driving the official unemployment rate to more than 6% in April. That's China's highest jobless rate since February 2020. Here in New York City, public health officials strongly recommended Monday people wear medical-grade masks indoors, but stop short of ordering a mask mandate. The warning came as New York prepared to raise its COVID alert level to high for the second time this month. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports the Food and Drug Administration is poised to authorize third-dose booster shots of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children age 5 to 11. Across the U.S., coronavirus hospitalizations are continuing to rise, with public health officials warning the nearly 100,000 new cases reported each day represents a significant undercount. The Supreme Court's conservative majority has sided with Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz in a case challenging a federal anti-bribery law. Writing for the majority in Monday's 6-3 opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts ruled that the First Amendment's guarantee of free speech protects the right of a candidate to use unlimited post-election contributions to repay loans made to their campaign. The federal campaign finance law, known as the McCain-Feingold Act, previously capped such loans at $250,000. In her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote, quote, "The theory of the legislation is easy to grasp. Political contributions that will line a candidate's own pockets given after his election to office pose a significant danger of corruption," she said. The Biden administration's easing Trump-era restrictions on travel between the United States and Cuba. The State Department said Monday it'll reinstate the Cuba Family Reunification Parole Program, expanding visa processing and making it easier for families to visit relatives in Cuba. The administration's also lifting a $1,000 cap on remittances family members can send to relatives in Cuba. The new measures fall short of U.S.-Cuban rapprochement seen under former President Obama. In occupied East Jerusalem, dozens of Palestinians were injured Monday as Israeli forces used rubber-coated steel bullets, tear gas, and foul-smelling skunk water to attack a funeral procession of a Palestinian man killed by Israeli soldiers. On Saturday, Walid al-Sharif succumbed to wounds he suffered April 22nd when Israeli troops shot him in the head with a rubber-coated bullet as they fired so-called less lethal munitions at worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. An eyewitness said Israeli forces left al-Sharif bleeding for nearly half an hour before he was finally taken to the hospital in a coma. He's among 54 Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the beginning of the year. Meanwhile, the Catholic Church's top official in Jerusalem has condemned Israeli police for their violent attack on last Friday's funeral for Shireen Abu Akleh. The veteran Al Jazeera journalist was killed last week covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank and an attack Palestinians and Al Jazeera blame on Israeli military snipers. Archbishop Pier Battista Pizzaballa said on Monday, Israel's attack on Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral was a severe violation of international norms and regulations.
The police stormed into a Christian health institute, disrespecting the church, disrespecting the health institute, disrespecting the memory of the deceased, and forcing the pallbearers almost to drop the coffin. Israeli police invasion and disproportionate use of force, attacking mourners, striking them with batons, using smoke grenades, shooting rubber bullets, frightening the hospital patients, is a severe violation of international norms and regulations.
In Lebanon, Hezbollah and its political allies have lost their majority in parliament after final results from Sunday's election showed no outright winner. The inconclusive outcome leaves Lebanon's parliament split among several camps, even as the nation grapples with soaring inflation, rampant poverty, and corruption. It was Lebanon's first election since a devastating economic collapse in 2019 and the massive 2020 explosion at the port of Beirut that killed at least 215 people while destroying entire neighborhoods. Sri Lanka's newly sworn-in prime minister has warned his nation is down to a one-day supply of gasoline as a devastating economic crisis is set to deepen. Ranil Wickremesinghe said Monday Sri Lanka's government will have to print money to pay government wages, even though it'll lead to the devaluation of the currency. He said Sri Lanka will seek to privatize its state-owned airline and called on citizens to accept even deeper austerity measures.
The next couple of months will be the most difficult ones of our lives. We must prepare ourselves to make some sacrifices and face the challenges of this period. I have no desire to hide the truth and to lie to the public. Although these facts are unpleasant and terrifying, this is the true situation.
In recent weeks, Sri Lanka has been rocked by protests demanding the ouster of the president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, among rolling blackouts, soaring inflation, and shortages of fuel, medicine, and water. Back in the United States, the Biden administration has announced a number of steps to alleviate a critical nationwide shortage of baby formula. The Food and Drug Administration and Abbott Laboratories have reached an agreement to allow Abbott to reopen the nation's largest baby formula plant, which was closed after due to concerns over bacterial contamination following the deaths of two babies. Meanwhile, the FDA has eased import rules on baby formula made overseas, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has said babies as young as 6 months old can now be fed cow's milk for a brief period of time due to the baby formula shortage. Up until now, pediatricians had recommended babies not be fed cow's milk until they are 1 year old. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. And the longtime LGBTQ lawyer and activist, Irva Shivad, has died at the age of 63. From 1989 to 1992, she headed the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and became an outspoken critic of the federal government's response to the AIDS crisis. In 1990, she interrupted a speech by President George H.W. Bush while holding a sign that read, "Talk is cheap, AIDS funding is not." She appeared on Democracy Now! In 2009.
I feel that, you know, as a woman of color, it's not really separable for me. Racial justice, gay rights, social justice, economic justice, they're intertwined. And the context that we live in requires, I think, the gay movement to see how intertwined our struggle is with the defeat of right-wing values and right-wing ideology.
To see our whole interview with Irva Shivad, you can go to our website. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction, Noam Chomsky. In his 2013 book, Nuclear War and Environmental Catastrophe, Noam Chomsky warned that we are facing, quote, two problems for our species' survival, nuclear war and environmental catastrophe. Up to this point in history, problems caused by humans were regional. However, just in the last few decades, climate change and nuclear war have become a threat to all life. Noam Chomsky was born in Philadelphia in 1928. He studied at the University of Pennsylvania, where he received his PhD in linguistics in 1955. In 1967, he gained public attention for his vocal opposition to U.S. involvement in the war on Vietnam, and he was arrested several times. He was appointed institute professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1976. Chomsky has written and lectured widely on linguistics, philosophy, history, contemporary issues, international affairs, and U.S. foreign policy. Chomsky was one of the acclaimed speakers at the Symposium on the Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction, organized by Dr. Helen Caldicott. The two-day event on February 28 and March 1, 2015, brought together 20-plus speakers on the topics of the risks of accidental nuclear war, expansion of weapons in space, the power and pathology of the U.S. military-industrial complex, the privatization of the U.S. nuclear weapons labs, and much more. And here's an insert made by me, Mariah Gallardon, in May 2022. I'm bringing back excerpts from the 2015 series on possible nuclear extinction because the nuclear danger today is higher than it was 7 years ago, and the geopolitical flashpoint is the same. As Noam Chomsky will reference in a few minutes, then as now, the two major nuclear powers, Russia and the U.S., are in confrontation over Ukraine. Here's Noam Chomsky.
Well, as all of us are all too well aware, a few weeks ago, the famous doomsday clock was advanced by 3 minutes towards midnight. That's a threat level that had not been reached for 30 years. The accompanying statement invoked the two major threats to survival, nuclear weapons and unchecked climate change. The call condemned world leaders who are endangering every person on Earth by failing to perform their most important duty, ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization. This grim declaration naturally brought to mind another one just 50 years ago, the appeal to the people of the world by Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein, calling on them to face a choice that is stark and dreadful and inescapable. Shall we put an end to the human race, or shall mankind renounce war? Recognizing, of course, that war can quickly turn into terminal nuclear war. The Russell-Einstein appeal differs from the current declaration in two crucial respects. It did not include the threat of environmental catastrophe, which is then not sufficiently understood, and it addresses the people of the world, not the political leadership. And that difference is of some importance. There is substantial evidence that on climate change, nuclear weapons planning, international policies generally, The population in general seems more concerned than the political leadership. It's hardly a secret that even the most free and democratic societies, governments, respond only in very limited ways to popular will. For the United States, it's well established in academic scholarship that a considerable majority of the population is literally disenfranchised at the lower end of the income wealth scale. Their opinions have no influence on policy. Influence increases slowly as one moves up the scale, and at the very top, which is actually a fraction of 1%, policy is pretty much determined. That being the case, the attitudes at the very top of the ladder are of quite considerable significance. These are revealed dramatically in a poll of CEOs that was released a few weeks ago at the Davos conference, the conference of the masters of the universe, as the business press describes them. The poll revealed that climate change did not merit inclusion among the top 19 risks that concern CEOs. Nuclear weapons were not even mentioned. Worse still, at the top of the perceived risks was regulation. That is the prime device for addressing environmental catastrophe. Their overriding concern was growth prospects for their companies. Well, the result's not surprising. Whatever their individual beliefs may be, in their institutional roles, the CEOs are constrained to adopt policies that are designed to pose extraordinary and undeniable threats to the continued existence of humanity, in the words of the Doomsday Clock Declaration. And given their enormous role in determining state policy, it's no less surprising that policy lags behind public opinion on the concerns that have moved the clock so close to midnight. And much the same is true of attitudes towards international affairs. Popular opinion diverges significantly from that of the decision-making classes. So a considerable majority of the public has held consistently that the United Nations, not the United States, should take the lead in international crises. Such views are so remote from elite opinion that they're barely even articulated publicly. A good part of the reason for this is the nature of elite opinion. And as is often the case, it's at the critical end of the spectrum that we find the most information, insight into these issues. So here's an example from a featured article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, the leading intellectual journal, kind of left liberal in orientation. The article's by Jessica Matthews, till recently the head of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And what she writes is that American contributions to international security, global economic growth, freedom, and human well-being have been so self-evidently unique and have been so clearly directed to others' benefit that Americans have long believed that the U.S. amounts to a different kind of country. Where others push their national interests, the U.S. tries to advance universal principles. Comment seems superfluous, except for the fact that this is indeed what many in enlightened circles believe, and the policy consequences are not obscure. It's worthwhile to take a careful look at how governments regard the principle that ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization is their most important duty. Regularly, governments have not considered security of the population to be a particularly high priority. So let's begin with the early days of the ultimate weapon. That was a time when the United States had overwhelming wealth and power, literally 50% of the world's wealth, remarkable security. There was, however, a potential threat, namely ICBMs with nuclear warheads. Now, there is a standard scholarly review, comprehensive review of nuclear policies by McGeorge Bundy, access to high-level sources. In this review, Bundy describes, I'll quote him, the timely development of ballistic missiles during the Eisenhower administration as one of the best achievements of those 8 years. But he continues that it is well to begin with a recognition that both the United States and the Soviet Union might be in much less nuclear danger today if these missiles had never been developed. And he then adds an instructive comment. I am aware of no serious contemporary proposal, in or out of government, that ballistic missiles should somehow be banned by agreement. One of the most startling comments I've ever read. In short, there was apparently no thought of trying to prevent the sole serious threat to the United States, the threat of utter destruction. Rather, the institutional imperatives of state power prevailed, rather in the case of the CEOs, for whom the fate of the species is of such little concern that it does not even enter into the rankings of concerns. We might ask whether the development of these missiles might have been prevented. Well, actually, there appear to have been opportunities. One suggestive indication is a proposal by Stalin in 1952 offering to allow Germany to be unified with free elections, which the communists were sure to lose, on condition that it not join a hostile military alliance. That's hardly an extreme condition in the light of the history of the preceding half century. Stalin's proposal was taken seriously by one respected political commentator, James Warburg, but apart from him, it was ignored or ridiculed. Actually, recent scholarship, interestingly, has begun to take a different view. The bitterly anti-communist Soviet scholar Adam Ulam takes the status of Stalin's proposal to be an unresolved mystery. He says, writes, Washington wasted little effort in flatly rejecting Moscow's initiative on grounds that were embarrassingly unconvincing, leaving open the basic question, was Stalin genuinely ready to sacrifice the newly created German Democratic Republic on the altar of real democracy, with consequences for world peace and American security that could have been enormous? One of the most respected Cold War scholars, Melvin Loeffler, reviewing recent research in Soviet archives, he points out that many scholars are surprised to discover that Lavrenty Beria, the sinister, brutal head of the secret police, proposed that the Kremlin offer the West a deal on the unification and neutralization of Germany, agreeing to sacrifice the East German communist regime to reduce East-West tensions and improve internal political and economic conditions in Russia, opportunities that were squandered in favor of securing German participation in NATO. Well, under the circumstances, it's not impossible that agreements might have been reached that would have protected the security of the population from the greatest threat on the horizon, namely utter destruction. But apparently the option was not even considered, and possible opportunities were dismissed with ridicule, another indication of how slight a role authentic security plays in state policy. these events from the early days of the Cold War have considerable resonance right now, as several speakers have discussed. What happened when the Cold War ended provides instructive lessons into its actual nature. One question has to do with the fate of NATO, now that the alleged threat of Russian invasion had disappeared. Mikhail Gorbachev agreed to allow a unified Germany to join NATO, again, a rather significant concession, but with a quid pro quo, that NATO would not expand one inch to the east. That's the phrase that was used in internal high-level discussions referring to East Germany. NATO at once expanded to East Germany. Gorbachev objected, but he was informed by the United States that there were only verbal commitments, nothing in writing. Clinton later expanded NATO to the borders of Russia. As you read a few days ago, NATO armored, U.S. armored vehicles are a couple of hundred yards from the Russian border in military exercises. As John Mearsheimer recently pointed out in Foreign Affairs, indications that Ukraine might be assimilated into the Western system, possibly even into NATO, could not fail to be threatening to any Russian leader. Last December, the Western-backed Ukrainian parliament voted 303-8 to rescind the policy of non-alignment, which had been adopted by the ousted president, and committed Ukraine, in their words, to deepen cooperation with NATO in order to achieve the criteria required for membership in this organization. The growing crisis concerning Ukraine is of no slight threat.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky, listing the flashpoints between Russia and the U.S. at the 2015 conference, The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction. All this is eerily prophetic, except the situation in May 2022 is so much worse, since open warfare has begun. Back to Noam Chomsky and his assessment of the Kennedy administration.
Well, let's go back to the 1950s. Other developments reveal the low priority assigned to security of the population. After Stalin's death, when Khrushchev took office, he recognized that Russia could not compete militarily with the United States, and that if Russia hoped to escape its economic backwardness and the devastating effect of the war, the arms race would have to be reversed. Accordingly, he proposed sharp mutual reductions in offensive weapons. The incoming Kennedy administration considered the offer and rejected it, instead turning to rapid military expansion. The late Kenneth Waltz, one of the leading international relations scholars, wrote that the Kennedy administration undertook the largest strategic and conventional peacetime military buildup the world has yet seen, even as Khrushchev was trying to carry through a major reduction in the conventional forces and to follow a strategy of minimum deterrence. And we did so even though the balance of strategic weapons greatly favored the United States. Once again, the decision harmed national security while enhancing state power. Now, there was, as you know, a claim of a missile gap in the 1960 election. There was indeed a missile gap greatly in the favor of the United States. When this was pointed out, National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy said that we'll continue to talk about the missile gap because it's a good shorthand for our general policy of massive rearmament. How severely all of this harmed national security was revealed very dramatically in 1962 when Khrushchev sent missiles to Cuba. That was in part a foolhardy attempt to right the balance, which is enormously in favor of the United States. Now, that set off what Arthur Schlesinger called the most dangerous moment in history. No need to review here what happened then, but it does merit careful thought. 10 years later, Henry Kissinger called a nuclear alert in the last days of the 1973 Israel-Arab War. Circumstances were interesting. The purpose of the nuclear alert was to warn the Russians not to interfere with his delicate diplomatic maneuvers, which were designed to secure an Israeli victory, but a limited victory, so that the U.S. would still be in control of the region unilaterally. And the maneuvers were delicate, as we learn from recently released archives. The United States and Russia had jointly imposed a ceasefire, but Kissinger secretly informed Israel that they could ignore it, hence the need for a nuclear alert to frighten the Russians away. Fortunately, they backed off again. Security of the population was, again, a matter of essentially no concern. 10 years after that, the Reagan administration came into office, launched operations to probe Russian defenses. That meant simulating air and naval attacks against the Soviet Union. These actions were undertaken at a very tense moment and, not surprisingly, caused great alarm in Russia. Now, that led to a major war scare in 1983. That's the last time the doomsday clock reached 3 minutes before midnight. And newly released Russian archives reveal that the danger was even more severe than historians had previously assumed. There's a recent U.S. intelligence study which concludes the war scare was for real. U.S. intelligence underestimated Russian concerns and underestimated the threat of a Russian preventative nuclear strike. Recently, we learned that it was even more dangerous than that. In the midst of these world-threatening developments, Russia's early warning systems, which are quite primitive as compared with ours, detected an incoming missile strike from the United States that sent the highest level alert. The officer on duty, Stanislav Petrov, decided that it was a false alarm and did not follow protocol. He did not transmit the warnings. That's the difference between life and death. Max Tegmark mentioned another crucial case 20 years earlier. A Russian submarine commander, Vasily Archipov, blocked the launching of nuclear-tipped torpedoes. This is in the middle of the missile crisis. That could have set off a terminal nuclear war. He blocked it. But we should remember that Russian protocol required that three commanders agreed to set off the missiles. Two of them agreed. One, Archipov, disagreed. That's why we're alive. That's one sign of how thin the thread is by which we hang over the abyss. Now, there are chilling estimates about the failures of U.S. systems, notably Seth Baum's recent study in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. He concludes, quite appropriately, that nuclear war is the black swan we can never see except in that brief moment when it is killing us. We delay eliminating the risk at our own peril. Now is the time to address the threat because now we are still alive. And the Russian systems are much more prone to accidental launch. Reviewing his long career as a strategic weapons planner, General Lee Butler, who's former commander of the Strategic Command, wrote that he had been, his words, among the most avid of these keepers of the faith in nuclear weapons. But it is now his burden to declare, with all of the conviction I can muster, that in my judgment they served us extremely ill. And he then raises a haunting question. By what authority do succeeding generations of leaders in the nuclear weapon states usurp the power to dictate the odds of continued life on our planet? And most urgently, why does such breathtaking audacity persist at a moment when we should stand trembling in the face of our folly and united in our commitment to abolish its most deadly manifestations? General Butler concluded that we have so far survived the nuclear age by some combination of skill, luck, and divine intervention, and I suspect the latter in greatest proportion. These are plainly not risks that would be accepted by any sane decision maker. They are being accepted by leaders who are perfectly sane, just as the risks of environmental catastrophe are being faced with eyes open and ignored by the masters of the universe, all trapped in an institutional logic that is deeply pathological, that must be cured, and quickly, if we are not to put an end to the human race, in Russell and Einstein's words.
That was Noam Chomsky, the renowned retired MIT professor of linguistics, political commentator, social justice activist, and anarcho-syndicalist. His 2013 book, Nuclear War and Environmental Catastrophe, is just one of over 100 authored or co-authored by him, and it's possibly his most urgent appeal to recover democracy and take the power of global destruction away from the tiny elite that holds it now. This talk by Noam Chomsky was recorded in 2015 at the symposium, The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction, organized by the physician and anti-nuclear campaigner, Dr. Helen Caldicott. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. For information, call 707-463-2654. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org, and the mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, with a C, like cat, Calpella, California, 95418. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.